Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Whitten.
Are we talking adult like Torchwood or adult like Cinemax after 11 p.m.?
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
What are scissor grenades? I want one.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing noobs and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 65 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we gather together all of the so-called expertise that we think we've developed about the Doctor since 2005, and see how well that really applies when we transition from brilliant HD to low fidelity. We will trade our orchestration for electric organs, trade our CGI for cardboard, and our sonic screwdrivers for plastic recorders and umbrellas. Because that's what we do.
Yay!
It is the long-awaited, long-anticipated, and often touted but never produced, officially unofficial GPR Classic Who Primer Night. So
woo-hoo.
This is going to get all the people off my friggin' back who've been telling me, you know, you go yapping about the 50th anniversary year and all of the tribute and the lip service to Classic Who, but all I know is New Who, and there's an awful lot back there, and I don't really want to watch it all because I've been told that half of it stinks. So what do I do? Well, we'll see if we can't make it even more confused. Tonight, due to some technical issues, Jay and I are going to be running this one on our own.
So Melissa's actually recording her opinions and her thoughts and stuff on this on a separate segment that you can find in the podcast stream. So if you're a gamer, consider this like your free DLC. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. All right, well, for those folks who were wondering about accessibility, and that's going to be a genuine concern, I'm going to put that right up front here. As it stands right now, obviously, you know, Netflix is only giving you access to a certain number of the episodes on online streaming. You can go ahead and you can purchase a good number of them on various collections on Amazon and other DVD distribution sites, but there are other ones that are just going to be difficult all around to get a hold of for one reason or another. We know this, but we're going to try to help you out as best we can. Bear in mind, out of the, what did I end up calling down to, seven episodes or so? Yeah,
seven stories.
Yeah, seven stories, because remember, this is done serial format, so each story broken up into multiple episodes. Four of them, I believe, are actually of the ones included on the Netflix stream of 13 or 14 episodes, or 13 or 14 stories that they have on there. So kudos to you folks.
And I mean, that makes sense because, you know, they're going to include the stuff that is going to be most most relevant for viewers. Mm-hmm. So it's yeah, you're going to have a wide selection, and most of the stuff that's on Netflix is quality stuff that if you're wanting to get into Classic Who, it's a good place to start.
Very much so.
We just picked out some of the ones that are going to help build the backstory and are going to help do the heavy lifting for you, basically.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to, when it came down to this particular list, this wasn't a matter of, and I'm going to put this in bold print right here, that this is not a matter of what we consider best of.
Oh, no. Okay, not by a long shot.
Yeah, get that out of your head, because some of these episodes aren't necessarily what we may consider to be, you know, top quality Classic Who for that particular instance of the Doctor, for example.
Right, but they are important to the overall story.
Important to the story and of particular benefit in some fashion, which we'll get into on each one, to people who would classify themselves as New Whovians. So if you're a 2005 and up and you want to know how to start to tackle the mountain, but you want episodes that are going to give you something that provide you some kind of a touchstone, something you can relate to what you currently know of the Doctor from everything that you've watched over the last few years, I think that's kind of why I grabbed certain ones to do that. And I also think the reason why, you know, as I said, four of them that are on this list of seven are on the Netflix streaming. There's even some crossover between the ones that were on the Netflix streams in addition to the ones that were chosen for the Doctor's Revisited series that we've been watching over the past year. You know, there's crossover there for a reason, or these ones keep showing up on these kind of lists for a reason, because some of them really just have that intrinsic value for people that want to have a greater understanding of the larger Doctor Who universe, or Whoniverse, however you want to.
Right.
So, without further ado...
Yeah, so we're going to start off with the Second Doctor. Now, I mean, I personally had the question, why don't we include the An Unearthly Child? Because obviously that's where it all started. That's the that's the jumping off point for the entire series, the entire 50-year history. But through some discussion, we kind of decided that, yes, while it's the beginning, it's the origin story, so to speak, there's not a lot to get out of it. And it's it kind of drags on, and it's not a very good story, not very compelling in its own right. So
it actually kind of muddies the water for some things that we understand about the Doctor today, because bear in mind, from everything you may have seen from Adventures in Space and Time and getting some origins on the production of the show itself, they didn't really have in mind a lot of the core tenets that the show was built on now. You know, they didn't have any sort of forward thought towards regenerations or iterations of the Doctor. They had the confusing element of the granddaughter, which to this day, yeah, you know, we don't have answers for or any clear indication.
We still question all that.
Exactly. So I was concerned that it might raise more questions than it answered. So for that reason alone, I kept it off of this particular list. But by all means, I mean, it's readily available to you. It's one of the more widely distributed because it is the first of everything. Just go, if you do choose to watch it, just bear in mind that you're going to be kind of, you know, you're going to have to deal with some sort of pacing issues, some production quality issues and things. But there's, yeah, you put those things on hooks.
We're definitely not saying that you shouldn't watch it. I mean, it's definitely important and you do want to watch it. It's just not crucial for you to start. It's not going to help you get into Classic Who by starting with that one.
Correct. Yeah. And it's got cavemen, so come on. all right. Well, as Jay said, we jumped ahead and actually started with the Second Doctor and actually season 6. And
the end of the Second Doctor.
Yeah. Yeah. And not, again, it's not anything away from all of Troughton's other body of work, because there are some brilliant episodes in there that I absolutely love. In fact, Second Doctor is one of my personal favorites because he was just so dynamic and had so much fun with the role and laid the groundwork for so much of what we see from more recent Doctors who try to go that kind of route.
And actually the favorite Doctor of Matt Smith as well. And a lot of the characteristics carry over, and you can see that, you know, not the least of which being the bow tie.
Yeah, so quite.
If you're a fan of 11, then the Second Doctor is a good place for you to go.
Well, so what we ended up choosing, as Jay just mentioned, was actually the final episode for Troughton in that series. And it was actually, I mean, you talk about, also, it was also the last episode shot in black and white for that season. Because by the time you jump into Third Doctor with the next following episode, it's the first one in living color. So we went with War Games, or The War Games, to be specific. This is, as I started exposing some other folks to this episode or to this story who had not seen it before, they said, wow, it seems like they go back and they start using the world wars a lot. Is that something they do a lot in Classic Who? And I said, well, I can see that connection being made. But bear in mind, a lot of the times when you're dealing with something in the 60s, you're still in recovery period post-World War II. So that topic is still, you know, within a 15 to 20 year window of fresh wounds. So it does make for good topical reference.
I mean, it's very similar to how for years and years up until, you know, just the near past, most everything was based around, if it needed a military basis, it was based around the Desert Storm. You know?
Exactly.
So wars live on in and people's memories for a long time after they end. So, you know, just put it in the time frame.
Exactly. Well, that begins our backdrop, but we start to realize that as our interaction, we start to find out more about this warlord character. Let's give a kind of a quick synopsis here, because this is going to be one of the episodes you might have a little harder time getting a hold of or getting access to, because it is one of the older stories. But you're dealing with something where these throughout the history of Earth, you've got entire armies that are being drawn out of time and taken to basically battle it out in, essentially, as the title implies, these giant war games. Doing so under the control of this malevolent warlord, whose argument is that, you know, these civilizations were going to kill each other off anyway, so why not do it for sport profit? Doctor
it
is
makes
called.
Perfect sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, we do that sort of thing all the time. You know, I buy, you know, batches of ants and I let them go at it. but there's the Doctor gets called in to get involved with this one, or gets himself intrinsically involved with this one, and takes it upon himself to help come up with the solution along with his companions Zoe and Jamie. Awesome companions, by the way.
Yes,
Jamie is top notch. Is actually compelled to deal with this at the Time Lord's behest, or the Time Lords get involved towards the end of this one, because this is a long one. This is one you talk about in the story. It gets broken up into, what was this, was 8 or 10?
10. There was, yeah, 10 episodes altogether for the serial.
Right, so you're dealing with over 3 hours worth of overall storytelling time to get this out, and it goes all over the place over the course of those. But you end up in the final episode of the story back on Gallifrey, and having the both the Warlord put on trial, and then the Doctor himself gets put on trial for all of his issues. This was one of the basic reasons why I thought this might be something valuable for New Whovians, because of the fact that it gives a bit of backstory, especially in the last couple of episodes of the story, as to why the Doctor is constantly winging it about as he is, and really doesn't want to have any more interaction with Gallifrey or the Time Lords than he absolutely has to. And it gives us some good concise explanation for that. Still, in a very Second Doctor fashion, fun. You know, well, they're so boring. They're so I just wanted to go out and, you know, and have fun. Well, that story changes a bit over the years, but that's the way he sort of perceives it as Second Doctor, which suits him well.
Yeah. I think. Yeah, and I mean, like I said before, if you're a fan of the 11th Doctor, you're going to find things to latch onto with this one. It's not – the pacing is completely different. I mean, they took what could have – really, I mean, I think it could have been turned into a two-part episode nowadays.
Oh, easily.
And they stretched it out over 10 episodes. Now, granted, these are half-hour episodes, so, you know, like Keir said, it's 3 or 4 hours of content, but still, it drags at times. I mean, it really drags at times. But if you can get past the pacing, there's a lot to dig out of this for, you know, if nothing else, just for historical aspects, you know, like learning why the Doctor, you know, was considered a criminal, and, you know, how he got the TARDIS and things like that. So, yeah. And just some great history on him, and, you know, painting him as the, you know, venerable character that he is.
Quite. And again, you know, his companions are very strong, which makes for some great interchange on that. And you're seeing these companions towards the end of their time with the Doctor, so they've really got a well-established relationship. So you get to see some of that really, really close bond. And another thing that I think really makes it of particular importance, and we're going to get into this over the next couple that we're going to include in this list, is the fact that as a result, and yes, spoilers, sweetie, I know I'm doing this, but as a result of his the repercussions, his sort of sentence, so to speak, from violating what sounds a lot like the Prime Directive from the Trek world, and saying that you're not, the Time Lords say that you're not supposed to interfere with other planetary existence, and the fact that the Doctor's, you know, all up bins when it comes to getting involved and interfering, they basically punish him by disabling his TARDIS and putting him on 20th century Earth until, you know, for as long as they see fit.
Yeah.
And not only that, they decide they're going to change his appearance.
So they force his regeneration, wipe his companions' memories, and put them back in back home. So he loses, you know, loses a life, loses his friends, loses his car. You know, he's grounded. He's the Time Lord equivalent of being grounded and sent to his room.
Yeah, go to your room until I tell you to come out. But it's not even his room. Go to somebody else's room.
Go to the room that you stole from that other kid.
Exactly. Don't go to the room where all the video games are. Which segues us nicely into what we'll have next list. So in terms of what you know, New Whovians can appreciate out of that, you know, that's what we're really hoping. And one of the things that we wanted each of the episodes on this list to do was to be something that takes what you already know and love and just says, okay, all the previous generations that got you there can be really enjoyed as well, because they're not as unfamiliar as they might seem. You know, yes, there are going to be some villains that you have never seen since or may never see again, or maybe dealing with situations that seem paltry in comparison to some of the stuff that we deal with in the last couple of series. You know, how many times has the universe been threatened out of existence over the last couple of years? Well, you know, maybe they didn't deal with that every week, that Classic Who, but there's some great stuff that you'll find familiar if you enjoy the scripts. So go ahead.
I was going to say, next we've got the introduction of the Third Doctor, the introduction of color, the introduction of being shot on film. We have the Spearhead from Space.
It's back at that point in the world where they invented color, and everybody lived their lives previous to that, black and white, as Bill Watterson said.
And I remember an interview where John Pertwee actually said, "Holy crap, my hair is actually white."
Yeah, and you got an ugly tattoo, too. that should have been covered up in makeup. So this was obviously the bookend to what had just been set up from the War Games. So you now have the Doctor in his third form, hasn't even seen himself yet, doesn't even know, had no say in how he was going to look, because at the end of War Games, games, they basically gave him a bunch of choices, and he said, no, that one's too old, too thin, too fat, too ugh, you know. And they said, well, fine, you're going to get stuck with what we give you, and they sent him back to Earth. So he's now dealing with the first glimpse of the Autons, which, you know, while not being the most dangerous creatures on the planet, mannequins with guns for their hands and such, they're not really going to be up there in the ranks of Daleks and Cybermen, but are still, you know, creepy in their own right, I think.
How many people have walked past a mannequin in a store and thought, man, that thing's watching me, and that's just kind of creepy. I'm going to go over here by the toys and just ignore that.
Especially now. I mean, look at it. We had, if this is the way that we first got our introduction to Third Doctor, we have them again at the introduction at New Who, you know, so we've got dealing with the Autons there, and the first word out of the Doctor's mouth is run, you know, so they're still a viable threat, I guess you could say. But this was one, I think, that, and by the way, this is one that you can get on Netflix. You can go ahead and grab it right now. It's definitely worth watching. I watch this one every couple of months or so because there's always some good stuff to enjoy about it. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason than the fact that, well, we'll get to that. I'm jumping ahead of myself. But let's just say UNIT is all up in this one, too. So, introduction to the Autons. You get to see a doctor. If Second Doctor in what we chose for War Games kind of gives you an idea of the space hobo, mm-hmm. and the being able to have some fun with it, very whimsical, very kind of madcap and unpredictable at times, or seemingly fixated on the tiniest little things while everything else is going completely bat guano around him, and he's looking, you know, for something in his pockets. This is Action Jackson Doctor.
Yes.
And it's good to know that we've got some representation of a classic Whovian Doctor who's willing to throw a punch. So,
yeah, and I mean, this came out right around the time of James Bond, so they were looking for that action star kind of vibe. So you get to see the Doctor really taking a hands-on approach to, you know, quite literally sometimes, to a lot of the problems that the previous Doctors would have talked their way out of.
Mm-hmm, quite. So this, again, you know, talk about something that a new Whovian Doctor relate to. This is where it starts becoming, rather than just using wits and humor to clever your way out, sometimes you genuinely have to either run or call upon a force outside of your own to get things done, which is where we obviously involve UNIT as well. I think this is something that New Whovian can benefit from, because when we see stuff in New Who that involves UNIT and they talk about this long-standing relationship they've had with the Doctor, and you're like, well, okay, I wonder what the story is behind that. This is a very clear picture of mm-hmm. where that story develops, because they end up bringing the Doctor on as their quote-unquote scientific advisor.
Yeah. And I mean, this isn't even the first time that he's encountered them, though. This is where the relationship really starts to build. But, you know, they say right out at the offset, you know, the Brig is saying, well, he doesn't look like the Doctor because he knew the Second Doctor. So
precisely. And that was more of a relationship indicative of who the Second Doctor was, whereas the Third Doctor kind of goes at things more in a strictly business fashion. So it ends up developing kind of a strictly business relationship, at least at the outset of their interaction, you know, Pertwee's interaction with the Brig. Changes a bit, you know, over time. You start to, which we'll see in a moment, where it starts to warm up again. But yeah, it is a very working relationship, which is a kind of a new level for them. And I think that's important for Whovians to pick up on.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great example of, you know, the way that the show could evolve. It's no longer, let's get somebody in there that kind of looks like William Hartnell and can act similar to him. This is a dynamic step away and saying, you know, what if he's a completely different person when he regenerates? And they really, really show that off this time.
Right. And it's interesting to kind of think about, too, the circumstances that have put him there, too. Remember, this is a punishment. This is a sentence that he's living out for a little while. So if the regeneration that they force him into, because he had no say in it, also involves a little bit of a personality shift that goes along with that transition. It's not just a new appearance. It's kind of an alteration of his underlying personality. You still see some hints and some glimmers of that, you know, that twinkle in his eye and that want to have a little, you know, a little adventure as well as the action. But this is this is something that if the Time Lord stuck him there, to sort of keep him out of harm's way, it should be a benefit. You know, he's always there to be an assistance or some sort of a doctor, a healer. So, which brings us to another Third Doctor episode that I chose to put on the list here, and that is The Three Doctors, which we actually just talked about last week when mm-hmm. we were talking about multiple Doctor iterations.
Yeah, so we go from the end of the Second Doctor to the intro of the Third Doctor to the close to the end of the third Doctor.
Close to. It does connect to those other two. We'll get to that in one sec. But yeah, this is a nice one to be able to kind of see third Doctor Ash, once he's got his roots in. He's now well established. The character's been fully fleshed out. He's sort of found himself, Pertwee has, in terms of what he's really bringing to the character. And the audience at this point is really well locked into his style. He was actually immensely popular at the time, you know, for what he did with the show, even though it had taken the show in some very different directions, you know, the action-oriented kind of approach. But public responded to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this one is, let's go ahead and sum this one up. This one is actually available on Netflix as well. And this is the first classic story that I ever sat down and like consciously made the effort to watch after I had been reintroduced to the series. I'd seen some when I was younger and I remember it vaguely, but I never kind of put two and two together. This is the first classic story that I really watched, knowing full well what I was getting into. Right. And it didn't disappoint. You know, you get to see, I mean, as the name says, you know, you get to see Pertwee, and then they bring in Troughton as well, and you get the appearance of Hartnell as well. So,
and it's done in a way that really allows, and the writing style, because the dialogue is actually very sharp. I really enjoy a lot of the exchanges between the doctors themselves, the exchanges of the companions with each of the doctors, and sort of seeing those hints of what they had before. You know, they definitely kept their characters intact coming back on screen again. I think in particular, it's great for any Whovian fan to see, you know, multiple Doctor iterations, because it kind of, you know, goes along with that kind of the whimsy of what the character is all about. But it's particularly great to see Pertwee and Troughton go at it with one another, because they have very, very distinct differences in what they feel the Doctor really embodies. You know, the space hobo and the action hero, I should say the scientific action hero, who tries to go at things, you know, as carefully and methodically as possible, whereas Troughton is spending all his time trying to find his lost recorder. And he'll stop in the middle of, you know, as the world is crashing around him and guns pointed at him and such, and all he's doing is crawling around on the floor trying to find his recorder. It's just, these are kind of the things that you can sit back and say, aside from the script, just these scenes are just fun to have an opportunity to add to your Whovian experience bank, so to speak. Yes. So you're dealing with, plot-wise, you're dealing with something I think is very, very important for new Whovians to have, and that's when it comes down to Time Lords requiring the Doctor. You know, we run into lots of instances of the Doctor, you know, being treated coolly or spikily, or the Time Lords seeing the Doctor as such because of some stuff that's happened in the past, whether it be the theft of the TARDIS or him just being a, you know, a sort of a rebel faction, so to speak. But this is one where they require immediate help. In dealing with one of their own, we come to find, or what would have been one of their own if things were left to the way that they wanted. So this is Omega. And we've talked about Omega when we were talking about our villain arc some time back. It was a pretty solid character, I think. I think the Omega theory was a pretty good one. You know, you got a Gallifreyan who felt who tried to do some amazing things having to do with harnessing the power of a collapsing star and the development of a black hole as a power source for the Time Lords, successfully doing so, but sacrificing himself in the process. Well, it turns out he wasn't dead.
Yeah, not as much. He was kind of dead in, like, the Master is dead again terms. Yeah. So we find out that he's actually the ruler of almost like a pocket universe that is shaped and held together purely by his will.
Yes.
And so he poses such a threat to the Time Lords that they're like, well, we need to get the Doctor and we need to get him involved. And crap, he's having a hard time. Well, let's get the Doctor.
Yeah. You know, who else can help the Doctor?
They bring in the second Doctor to help him out. And then that's not enough. So they bring in the first Doctor to help him out. So, you know, here we've got a villain that it takes three iterations of the Doctor to take down.
Yeah, yeah. And a little bit of wrestling and such, too. So you still get your action aspect of it. But for new Whovians in particular, I think you one of the great benefits that you gain out of this, again, a lot of involvement from UNIT. The Brigadier is phenomenal in this one. Absolutely love the Brig's involvement in this particular set, because of the fact that he's got to grapple with the fact that, you know, he's dealing with the Doctor he's just started to get to know. Now he sees the Doctor that he knew all along, and has to be told, because he still hasn't grasped the idea that it could be one and the same. And then he sees on the screen, he's got the appearance of the first Doctor, who's basically... slapping the two other children around for the way that they behave nine times out of ten. And the brig actually turns to Benton and says, well, who's this one? He says, well, he's the doc too. Or, you know, I'm paraphrasing here. He says, no. Oh, God. Oh, no. Okay. No. All right. It's more than he wants to know, let alone has to process. Yeah. So the brig and Benton are great in this one. There's a lot of action. There's a lot of straight up humor, good suspense and danger, a decent amount of actual scientific basis in fact for some of this stuff. The idea of the, you know, drawing the power, the pulsar that emits from the center of a black hole, the only thing that can possibly escape a black hole, is an immense power source if that can be harnessed. Wow, geez, they were doing this in the 60s for crying out loud, and they had this figured out. Or the fact that there may be something on the other side. Well, if there's something on the other side, it must be an antimatter universe. Well, this is all actually decent scientific theory here. So it just shows that they were putting a lot more attention into the complexity of their scripts. So that, I think, will make it more approachable for new Whovians who just don't understand. Well, I don't, why? Why is it's a they're living statues? Why is that bad? You just melt them. So this is a little more of a something on the scale that we might expect a new Who episode to be involved with. So at this point, now we start getting into some of the real. You know, we're talking about the scripts improving or and the pace actually improving too as we start getting you know, further into the 60s and 70s at this point. Well, we get ourselves to an episode that I think is pretty damn important on a number of levels here for a lot of reasons. But I'm not even going to bother getting into all the reasons because the title pretty much says it all. Get yourself into Fourth Doctor. So you got Tom Baker. Always going to love it. You're never going to be disappointed with dialogue or things of that sort because it's all going to be kind of witty and sharp and something that's going to be very familiar to people who are, you know, fans of 9th, 10th, 11th. Because when it comes to the speed and the nature of the exchanges and those sorts of things, a lot of that cut its teeth on what Baker could bring to the role.
Yeah.
So you're definitely gonna feel like you're in some comfortable territory for new Whovians. But we went with Genesis of the Daleks. So we're in a season 12 at this point. So basically, there's an opportunity to go back and intercept the creation of the Daleks in their entirety. Sort of the idea of going back and killing Hitler, kind of that sort of approach. But we also involve, of course, if you're talking about the origin story behind the Daleks, which is a great thing for Whovians of any nature to know, you've got the first real interaction with Davros, who is just, come on.
The Doctor didn't know at this point. That was the thing that caught me off guard. It's like they make reference to Davros and the Doctor's like, well, what's that? And I'm like, what?
Yes, you've gone you far enough into Davros? The Wayback Machine that he doesn't even know who he is.
This was just such a fun episode. I mean, you get to see, like you said, Tom Baker, who it doesn't matter which Doctor is yours, you're going to love Tom Baker. He might not be your favorite, but he's definitely somebody that you can't help but like. You know, and then you've got you've got Sarah Jane.
Yes.
You know, one of the most famous companions ever. Everybody loves her. And Henry, who I'll be honest, I don't know a whole lot about, but he actually is a great counterpoint to the Doctor. I mean, they have some fantastic chemistry on screen.
Yeah. Henry is a kind of a throwback to the idea of having the companion as the straight man to the randomness of the Doctor at times. And it doesn't get much more random than Baker. So, you know, you've got Henry who has to be the one to stand there and go, what? So he's your reaction of the voice of reason that often gets completely ignored and go crashing forward anyway. So and not to mention the fact that this is one of those ones where you don't have to worry about, just from the nature of the script itself, you're going to get a very, very comfortable feel from the fact that we're dealing with that classic trope of, you know, you have the opportunity, in this case it happens to be touching two wires together, but you have the opportunity at the push of a button to eliminate a threat that you know is going to cause all of the strife and torment down the road for other civilizations and other species or other lives, you know, make it just more general. But do you have that right to be to enact that genocide in the name of future future wrongs, or do you have the right to be that executioner? And so it causes some really, really poignant discussion, not only from the Doctor, but also his exchanges with Davros that I think are valuable to know for new Whovians as in terms of the backdrop of some of the things that become the moral quandaries that the Doctor's before and after, really. But this is one of the best exemplifications of those moral dilemmas that he has to deal with, which may, to us, from the viewer, you're like, do it, touch the wires together. Boy, it's a freaking Daleks. What are you doing?
Yeah.
But he actually explains his case, and you think, all right. because it comes down to, am I any better than them if I do this?
Yeah, like how many am I killing? Save, how many more? You can't treat people like math problems. So it is really great to see the doctor start to wrestle with that, even this early on. And this is a theme that gets come back to plenty of times. I mean, Trial of a Time Lord, we see the doctor actually pull the trigger on that one and commit genocide at one point. And having this as the backdrop, you kind of understand the weight of what he did there. And then, the Time War, which, whatever it is now, it's knowing that he committed double genocide, and knowing his feelings on it. And then seeing that happen really adds a lot of weight to it. So if for no other reason, I mean, the origin of the Daleks is enough reason right there. But just to get his viewpoint on genocide and his viewpoint on, what makes actions justifiable is great to go back to.
So you get that, you get your teeth cut on that one. Again, this is going to be one of those ones you're going to have to do a little seeking out in order to get access to it. I know that there are certain scenes and certain clips and things where you can get, fairly lengthy clips that you can get a hold of on YouTube as well. But getting the episodes in their entirety might be a little bit more of a challenge. We'll work on that. but while you're in that Fourth Doctor mindset, I'm gonna put out there one of my personal favorites on all levels. Doesn't matter if I'm showing this to a new Whovian. Doesn't matter if I'm showing this to someone who's never seen any Doctor Who before at all. I like cracking this episode out as often as I can because it's just, I adore it. And that's City of Death. Also, one of the Netflix episodes and one that you should keep on your queue at all times because you're dealing with, plot backdrop is you've got an alien race, leader of an alien race who is hellbent on creating his own ability for time travel and is doing so through a very roundabout way of gathering all this theft or otherwise shady acquisition of priceless works of art, namely the Mona Lisa and others, and gathering, amassing some technology and a poorly beat upon scientist as well in the attempts to do so. The script is stellar because why?
Why is that?
Because the writer is actually Douglas Adams, writing under a pseudonym. So the dialogue is like whipcrack clever. It's so well catered to Baker. You would think I would love to be in a room where Adams and Baker were actually, working through rewrites and edits on some of the lines and having him play around with delivery on certain things, because you end up with any time where the count and countess are sitting there and they're having their little wars of words and the snark levels are through the roof. Oh, yes. This thing, whether he's dealing with the count as the count or dealing with him as the Jaggeroth, the most well-dressed, ugly-looking green spaghetti-faced monster on the planet, but still has a pocket square, so it's just crazy. Love it.
Yeah, I mean, and you get to see Baker in his element in this episode. He's being shoved into a room at gunpoint and does not stop talking for like 2 minutes straight. The whole time, talking about what a lovely butler. He's so fantastic. Fantastically violent and then just stealing a chair that it probably costs thousands of dollars even back in the day and demanding somebody bring him a drink or something all while at gunpoint. I mean, he's just completely on top of his game and it seems so completely random, but that he is just controlling the room.
Yeah. As he's devouring the scene, he is manipulating everything because he's taking stock of everything around him as he's seemingly just blathering for about 10 minutes straight. And you've got a great companion. We're dealing with Romana too. So you've got another Gallifreyan at his side and she's wicked smart. and knows how to deal with the doctor when he's off on his tangent thing. And she doesn't require any sort of explaining to because she's right there with him. So it's almost like you get this nice team effort between the two. In fact, in this one, you've got what's our buddy's name there? The
I was just going to say, I can't remember his name, but the detective that or the police officer or something that winds up teaming up with him.
Oh, Duggan. Right. You're dealing with Duggan.
Yes.
Duggan is basically, he is the whipping boy through this entire thing. Jokes made at his expense. He gets used as a blunt object for certain scenes. It's hilarious, and he becomes part of the fun as well. I'm really sad that they never used him again because he could.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say for one off companions, he's definitely up there in my top three.
Yeah,
I mean he's up there with Wilf.
Wow. Okay. Well, but then you've also, you're dealing with something where the entire episode was shot on, a great deal of the episode was shot actually in Paris. So these great location scenes of them coming, running around and so forth, which gives them some nice depth to the episode. Almost a cinematic feel at times. So just a lot of fun. I love this one. Absolutely love it. So new Whovians are going to be able to gain quite a bit from this because they get to see, similarly to like an Amy Pond or a Clara, you've got a companion who's like right there on par with the Doctor in terms of, you know, she can dish it as well as she can take it. You've got the comedic elements, which are going to be smack very familiar for 10th and 11th Doctor. Mm-hmm. It's just all around solid stuff.
And I mean, the storyline actually involves time travel. It's not let's travel to this time and have a story there. It's I have a time machine. Let me use that to help me fix this problem. And I mean, that one of those aspects that I love seeing in this show and never gets used enough. But I mean, this is all through it. You know, the Doctor's jumping around in the TARDIS, doing this, doing that, and, you know, actually using it to its full capability. And, yeah. You know, again, you've got a writer, Douglas Adams, who understands, you know, how to do that properly. Mm-hmm. And can use it to great effect, and it just works brilliantly.
Yeah, I think so too. It's nice to know that sometimes it's not just being used as a convention to get you from scene location to scene location, but it's something that has an intrinsic involvement with the script and actually a little bit of presence of mind as to what the ramifications are. So that's the mark of having a solid writer behind, and we see that happen New Who all the time. Eventually, we've got to be able to step away from our beloved Tom Baker, but we're still going to be in comfortable territory because we're dealing with, especially in my estimation, Doctor Who is a great segue or a great bridge from Classic Who to New Who, and that's Peter Davison as the Fifth Doctor. And with Earth,
I mean, if Baker was like the pinnacle of Classic Doctor, then Davison was definitely the first steps along the road to New Who.
Right. So we went with Earthshock out of season 19. Now, Earthshock gets all kinds of interesting asterisks and things hung off of it because there were a lot of aspects of that particular story that that were a change for what the show would do, specifically in terms of what they would do for some of the darker elements of the show at times. But you're dealing with a Cyberman episode. You're dealing with something that's that has to do with the idea of these future point archaeologists who are starting to unearth some of the aspects of what turns out to be a long game that the Cyber play, and they've decided they're going to keep people away from Sandbox, and Doctor gets involved. So I know, Jay, you're particularly attuned to this episode. This is one of your favorites, correct?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say one of my personal favorites, but definitely pivotal as far as Classic Who goes. I mean, I think that it was done in a very interesting way. I mean, through the entirety of the first episode, you have no idea that it's the Cybermen. I mean, it's the big reveal at the very end of the episode, but it's not one of those that it's built up to. It's just kind of like, oh crap, they threw in the Cybermen, awesome. You know, that was something different that you didn't really see in Classic Who. You know, normally it's like you kind of had inklings going into it what was going to happen, and this one it was just kind of like you hear in the last like 3 minutes of the first episode, oh well, they're androids, okay, we've dealt with androids, we understand that. Oh, they're androids being controlled by Cybermen, got it, okay. So it's just an interesting way of doing that was fairly new as far as I remember. But the big thing that we take away from this is that this was actually the serial that killed off a companion.
Right. Which it took a lot of people by surprise. Talk about hate mail to the BBC and things of that sort. So Adric bites it in this one. And this was a love or hate sort of a response. Some people kind of agreed with it and felt that it was a matter of, you know, the show had been getting darker or had touched on dark undertones, but it had people in mortal peril before. But didn't it just seem a little ridiculous, nobody ever actually died? Well, there you go. But it was actually done in an interesting way as far as the suicide mission, so to speak, however you want to call it.
I mean, the way that it was revealed on screen, I mean, you see the standard, oh, Adric's trapped on the ship and the Doctor's trying to save him, and you know, it's like, you know, something is going to happen at the very last second to where the Doctor's able to get to him and take him off to safety, and it doesn't happen.
Right.
You see the ship blow up and everyone on the TARDIS just kind of standing there staring at the screen, and then the credits roll. And I mean, that's it. And there's no music. It's the credits are completely silent. And I was sitting there like just stunned. I knew that it was going to happen when I watched it. And I'm still just like, you see it blow up. You see the Doctor just kind of like, what the heck just happened? And then, I mean, the credits with Adric's crumpled star of mathematical achievement or whatever it was, and the credits rolling over it with absolutely no sound. And I sat there just staring at that the entire time the credits rolled, and I never sit through credits. I never do that. Mm-hmm. and I could not take my eyes off the screen. There's no sound. There's no movement aside from the scrolling. And I'm just like, I cannot believe how that, it was just a fantastic way of doing it.
And how often do we see that now in newer series and things where when they really want to punctuate one of those giant moments at the end, you know, think about something like Walking Dead or another show like that, where you'll have this horrible thing that happens. I hate to do this to folks, but take The Red Wedding.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones, some crazy stuff happens. I'm not going to go into any more detail than this. Some crazy stuff happens, and rather than playing any theme music on the outro, it's just a black screen, credits, silence. And that speaks volumes. So I mean,
that is just remarkably powerful.
Yeah, so that just shows that the series here, that Doctor Who around this era, was ready to start making those kind of jumps and take those kind of risks. So that definitely changed the face of what you could possibly accomplish with the show, if they were willing to say, this isn't just, you know, this isn't a kiddie show at all times. You know, you can have the kids in here, but every once in a while, you're going to want to hide them behind the couch. Or at this point, you're just going to want to suddenly turn their heads forcibly away from the screen because some dangerous stuff is going to happen. Well,
I mean, this is the only time that we've seen a companion die, like, ever. I mean, granted, yes, we had Amy and Rory that got zapped back in time, but we saw that they lived to a ripe old age and, you know, they were happy together and everything. This is the only time where a companion has actually been killed and not come back through rebooting the universe or something, you know, it's...
Right. We deal with the loss of companions through one means or another, but it's never something this abrupt.
Yeah.
Yet. Who knows? Who knows? Well, I took a little bit of a jump here on what we have down for our last one on the list. I jumped over Sixth Doctor, and that's to take absolutely nothing away from Colin and everything that he added to the role, but that he had a very tough position as far as what he was looking to establish. He was taking a very popular, socially nice guy, Fifth Doctor, the compassionate, the empath, the one who really was just, you know, hard on his sleeve, so to speak, and
you put in an arrogant, cocky jerk off
for a reason, because they were really trying to start pushing the show into something that would be would be spiky and confrontational and get people talking about what happened, not just what they saw.
Yeah.
So that may not be something you want to push a new Whovian into unprepared.
Yeah, I mean, hell, I know a lot of diehard Whovians that, you know, myself included to a certain extent, that just refuse to watch Colin Baker because they can't stand him. I don't completely hate him, but it's going to take something serious for me to say, you know what, I feel like watching a Colin Baker episode. It just doesn't happen very often.
I would say once you start really, you know, getting your, you know, solid legs underneath you as far as watching Classic Who episodes, and you start feeling a little more comfortable with it, and you do want to see some Colin Baker, I'd probably say to go with Trial of the Time Lord series, because that's got some, it's pretty interesting to be able to see the different ways that the Doctor is being manipulated. Again, you know, it's got some good Time Lord connection in there, back to Gallifrey. It's got, you know, some dealing with some of the issues of as Jay was mentioning earlier, the genocide concept, the idea of how much manipulation can you have in a species or a civilization's timeline. You know, can you observe without being intrinsically involved? Is there a point where you should become involved? If there's something you can do, do you do it? So that's some pretty good stuff to have under your belt, but I'd wait.
Yeah, I mean, if this is Classic Who 101, then that's definitely going to be Advanced Who.
Yeah, that's a 201 or a 301 course right there. So, so we jumped ahead. And I said, okay, if I'm going to grab some Seventh Doctor, and there's some good Seventh Doctor stuff that you can enjoy. You know, the Dragons episode is always a pretty good one. You've got his finale episode is a really strong one too, Battlefield and so forth. But
Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yep, absolutely. Great stuff that you can enjoy from Sylvester, because again, it kind of goes back to you know, good companion relationships. You've got the idea of a Doctor who can be a little unpredictable and sort of you know, off on wild tangents or adventures at the drop of a hat, but at the same time, he's got some of that dark element to him that I don't think Troughton ever really conveyed. Troughton really wanted to be everyone's, you know, lovable Doctor. McCoy maintained some of that, but he also knew that trouble was afoot and had a lot of those undertones to him that came to the surface. And so the episode that I went with to kind of pull that apart was Curse of Fenric, also available on Netflix for you folks. So this is one that's, it really, you talk about how much can you jam into a story here. You start out with Russians washing up on the beach. You've got scientists who are trying to use Viking runes and machines built on deciphering runes that are also going to be used for Nazi code breaking techniques. Then you start to deal with Viking curses. Now you got vampires involved, but they're not really vampires. They're something else. It's all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really, almost spastic episode or serial just because of those reasons where they throw everything at you so quick and just jam-packed full of stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is definitely a great episode for someone who wants to see where the show has come from, basically.
Yeah, it is, and I will admit it, there are times in this particular story where it seems like they're a little bit scattered, like they're trying to incorporate too much into it. I will agree with that. There may be times also when you get really sick of the two British girls who are slowly turning into monsters because their acting is atrocious. I will give you that as well. But I think for new Whovians, some of the great things that you can pull out of this, again, because I like going back on this because it's one of the things that new Whovians really latch onto, and that has to do with companion relationships. You can't get a much tighter symbiotic relationship between Doctor and Companion than you have with Seventh Doctor and Ace. They need each other.
And Ace really, she is the template for the modern companion. You know, you've got a lot of these companions that, you know, they don't fit with what you're used to with Rose and Amy and Clara. And, you know, you're just kind of like, well, why aren't they helping? Why are they just running and screaming? And you know, why aren't they doing something? And with Ace, you really get to see that start to develop. I mean, she really is a hands-on companion and really does start to help the Doctor more than just to be there as a sounding board and a reason for him to give exposition.
Yeah, she's very progressive. She's very forward-thinking, forward-acting. There's times when the Doctor has to hold her back because she's ready to tear forward into the thick of it before he's even ready reasoning it out. So that's always a good one to have. Great dialogue from McCoy. Some of the writing that they give him is solid because he's actually, you know, for that funny little lisp of his, he's still got a great opportunity to be able to convey some of the more serious elements. And because of the fact that he's often kind of this almost a Charlie Chaplin tottering around thing, waving his umbrella and being, you know, doing his magic tricks and being that sort of fun character, it strikes you that much more as a poignant element when he decides to drop serious. It means more, which I think is a great thing for new Whovians that they can touch on. They can say, ah, I see that with Tennant. You know, Tennant would go off and he'd have these madcap adventures, and all of a sudden when he went serious Doctor or Dark Doctor,
you knew that stuff was going to hit the fan.
Exactly. Just short of hearing, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
So, you know, and when he has to talk about some of the, you know, again, we mentioned this before, making the tough decisions, the tough calls, understanding when sacrifices need to be made or, you know, when is the greater good, the need of the one, the need of the many, and that sort of thing, and those great moral dilemmas, McCoy has to deal with a bunch of those because think about where you are in the timeline of what you know about previous iterations of the Doctor. This is where we're starting to build up things about, like, we're getting close to Eighth Doctor territory, we're getting close to Time War territory. The Doctor has been dealing with century upon century of more of these serious aspects and seeing these species that are not only out for their own personal agendas, but a lot of them are gunning directly for him. He is starting to become a threat, a known threat around the universe. So...
So, I mean, this is a great episode just to show, you know, you can really sit and watch this and see where a new Who has picked up, you know, and where the threads were kind of left that led into the, you know, the Paul McGann movie and the just the way that the show is now. You know, it really kind of laid the groundwork for that and gave us a lot of precedent for what we know now. So, it's a little hard to get into. You don't want to start with this one, just because it is meaty and there's a lot of stuff into it and it is hard to keep track of at times. But this definitely does need to be in your first few episodes for a lot of the reasons we've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm. But, very much so. But again, bear in mind, this was, I think, second to last of McCoy's episodes. So, you know,
where it falls.
I believe so.
It's in there.
And then because I think right after Curse of Fenric was the, oh God, what was it? Not Battlefield, Survival. which was, I believe, his finale. So that was the end of Ace, so forth. And I actually, down to the last couple of days, I was just trying to debate for myself whether or not I wanted to include, if I was going to have a Seventh Doctor one on the list, whether it was going to be either that one or Survival. Survival is actually a really solid episode on a lot of reasons, even because it has one of the best, and this is, again, you know, speaking because we're doing this for new Whovians, you want to talk about master interactions. This is a great, great battle of wits between Seventh Doctor and Master. And even though it involves the cheetah people, which is kind of, all right, fine. You know, every episode's got its lemon rotting in the back of the room there somewhere. But this is a really, really solid one for that alone. You know, they get into a battle where it's nearly a fist fight in the middle of the street. And at the same time, they're having a great verbal exchange that really signifies where both of them are as far as they're dealing with their longevity, their pseudo immortality, and so forth. So definitely a good one to be able to grab a hold as well. So I would almost consider this as a two in terms of mandate, but you'll be able to get a hold of the former episode of Fenric on Netflix. You'll have to work a little harder to get your hand in Survival.
And that's part of the reason why this one got picked instead of the others, availability. But I mean, this list is far from comprehensive. It's just these are good titles to get you started. I mean, there's all kinds of episodes that you're going to want to get into once you do start to dig into it. But these are a good place to get you in, get you familiar with the syntax of the classic episode, the pacing in a lot of episodes or in a lot of instances, and really get you a good feel for what it is that you're about to delve into. Because I mean, you know, we just celebrated the 50th anniversary. There's a reason why it's had 50 years. You know, go and dig into it and find out.
Worthy.
Do you want to throw in some almost made it's the episodes that could easily be included but we haven't?
I don't know. Do you have ones on your personal list that you would want to include?
I mean, there are some that you're going to want to check into that might not be in your first go round, but I know Remembrance of the Daleks is another Seventh Doctor serial that if you're into the Daleks and if you enjoy that kind of thing, it's a good one to dig into. I'm trying to the Pyramids of Mars, which is available on Netflix, is a great episode for Tom Baker and Sarah Jane. I mean, just watching the two of them on screen together in that serial is fantastic. And and there's fezzes all over the place. It's great.
A plethora of fezzes. you might say Caves of Androzani, although for that one, again, that's one of those instances where I'd be a little wary that if you didn't really have a preparation for some of the underpinnings that separate classic Who quality from new Who quality, story is solid, but it might leave more questions than it answers. That being one of the Netflix set, by the way, but I might say that they were just getting introduced to hold back on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is a great episode, and you can see, once you understand where the show was at that point, it's a great introduction or a great showing of how they were trying to evolve the show and turn it into something that fit the time more than just sticking to the tried and true formula.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's definitely one that gets in there. I thought we had some responses. Some
folks that wanted to inject. Absolutely, I'd love to hear. And I want to keep hearing from that too, because I know this is going to, you know, people are readying their flamethrowers at this point.
Okay, so Stargate Pioneer was asking, said, I'm contemplating a good K-9 Sarah Jane episode to add to the mix. Do you have one already picked out? We did not. Can you think of anything off the top of your head?
Well, not specifically a K-9 and Sarah Jane. Obviously, we've got Sarah Jane involved in our episode selection here, but... I'm trying to think of one in particular that would jump out. I don't know, because that's a lot of, if anything, I would probably say, and I'll have to go back to actually to check it, would be K-9's actual origin episode, where you see the professor actually assembling him and the reason why he ends up becoming a sort of an unlikely companion, what his original intent was. Because then if you sort of warm up to the idea of having this sort of pseudo companion or this lunchbox slash companion and sort of appreciate him from the early stages, that might be a nice door opener for some of the future Sarah Jane related episodes. And even the spinoffs and things of that sort that continue to play with that. I think in particular, it was really a matter of seeing Sarah Jane specifically with Baker on that. Canine, while near and dear to my little tin heart, would not necessarily be something I would say is imperative for new Whovians to be able to jump back to.
Yeah.
It's cute, but...
Okay. Then we had, listener Richard asked that we please include Genesis of the Daleks. So we already got that one.
Done.
See, we know what's up. We know what you're asking. We finally listened to you guys. This is it.
This time.
This is crisp for you. Don't expect it again. No, but, yeah, so I mean, there's tons of stuff out there, and I mean, if you get through this and you want more, you know, definitely write us and let us know. And I mean, we will be more than willing to give you all kinds of recommendations from where to go from here. We're just trying to lay the groundwork for your new obsession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if there are, like, bear in mind, you know, we jumped over First Doctor for a couple of reasons, you know, but if you really want to know, I want to know what the ideal First Doctor episode to watch would be. You know, if I really wanted to see Hartnell at his fullest, you know, what should I watch? You know, we can definitely address that. So hit us up if you want that. We jumped over sixth, you know, but I did say, maybe Trial of Time Lord. There may be others, though, that I think might be easier transitions into Colin Baker and all of his ego. We can do that too. But chat with us, you know, shoot us some messages, throw us some tweets and such, and we'll take this further.
Absolutely. All right. So that's the end of that list. We do have some news leading into this this final week before Christmas, our last week with Smith as the Doctor. So what's your plan here? Are you gonna mainline Smith's run, or are you just gonna hit some of the highlights before Christmas?
I don't know if I'm gonna actually do that. I might, you know, obviously we'll go make one more run through Day of the Doctor, get myself back in the mindset of it. In fact, I'll probably end up watching the finale, the 50th, and then be prepared for this one. But I may actually, just for the heck of it, just for novelty's sake, go back and watch a lot of the Christmas eps, because, yeah, you know, they've definitely, as we've discussed, they are slowly becoming more and more of an intrinsic part of the natural flow and order of each series, rather than just fun little codas or one-offs they put together for the kids, you know. Yes. These are now part of what's driving the storyline, and if everything's to be believed, this one is going to be not only driving it, it's going to be careening off a cliff with it. So, you know, I'm going to make probably about a day of it, but it's not going to be a marathon.
Yeah, I'm definitely, I think I might hit a couple of the later stuff, like you said, the Day of the Doctor, the Name of the Doctor, and try and get those in as well. But I've reserved the hour before the Christmas special to watch 11th Hour, mm-hmm, because I want to watch that going right into the Christmas episode, because I feel like that would be a good way to bookend it.
Yeah.
Well, that's my plan, but we do have a new trailer for the Time of the Doctor.
Yes.
And this one gives us a little bit more to dig into, and as I experienced today, spend 45 minutes to an hour discussing with people and coming up with all kinds of crackpot theories as to who the woman in the trailer is.
Yes, the woman with the Duran Duran makeup. Who is she?
Yes. We've hit everything from the Ronnie to Romana to Jenny to Susan. My quarter's going on the table right now. It is a descendant of Susan. That's what I'm calling right now. We'll see if I get to pick quarter up or not, but
yeah, I'm taking the real step back approach on this one, just saying that it's going to be a crafted character for the sake of this particular episode that will help sort of tie in it, that rather than circling back to a character that we haven't seen in eons, this is going to be one that's going to be crafted in order to connect all of the disparate threads of everything we're seeing in the trailers, as far as all the villains that are amassed and how they're actually coming together for this siege of Trenzalore that's being referenced. So I think rather than really, really overcomplicating it, you know, talk about everything you're trying to pack into a single episode, I think it'd just be too much to say, you know, it's your granddaughter again, or it's the Rana's back again, or, oh, you know, it's just, no.
Well, I mean, listener Badgerspoon, he was talking with me earlier, and, you know, he brought up the idea of it being Susan, and concise way of putting it, he said, you know, the first companion being present at his final death has a certain symmetry. Yeah, you know, which, I mean, we know Moffat has come out saying that, you know, technically Smith is the 13th regeneration, so this is supposed to be the end of his life. You know, we're gonna find out how he is supposedly going. So I can understand what he's saying there, that, you know, you've got Susan there at the very beginning and having her, or, you know, as I'm thinking it is, a descendant of hers there at the very end. Mm. You know, I can see Moffat pulling that kind of thing, because he's been doing that a lot, pulling in classic elements and giving them a twist so that we don't see it coming. So we'll see what happens. But we've also got Moffat discussing the War Doctor's past and the 12th Doctor's future.
Yeah, kind of justification here, you know. It was him sort of reminiscing or sort of taking on a little bit of the, it wasn't criticisms, but it was really a matter of saying, you know, how much, why is it that you're doing these things now? Why are you starting to stitch together these stories or close, or I should say reopen and then close some of these chapters that we've had up to this point? And so in this particular interview, he was just basically saying that he liked the introduction of John Hurt's Doctor, the War Doctor, the, you know, 8.5, whatever you want to call him, because of the fact that there was that huge section that we keep seeing referenced ominously, that obviously, as we all agree, would make for great television, you know.
Yeah.
And he says in these instances where there would be issues where they'd be talking about Tennant referencing the Time War and saying, you know, I was a part of this, and he just couldn't quite. He couldn't conceptualize that, you know, seeing Tennant as Tennant or Ten as Ten, just it's not him. So the idea of having a doctor that, rather than being the rescuer, is actually the warrior in it, really warranted the idea of having John Hurt as that sort of character. Now, in terms of whether he plans on doing, as we had hypothesized, you know, maybe they could do flashback moments or something every once in a while, or have him as appearances and little scenes that could be dropped in, oh, I remember when, and then we have that moment. He didn't give any further exposition on that. But then he jumped ahead to deal with some of the other viewer concerns that had to be the fact, is Capaldi just going to come out and spew profanities in every episode and tell people that he's got a, you know, an app that blows people up with grenades and things on his phone and so forth, and all the things that we come to recognize the thick of it role for Mr. Tucker. So he's the Mop's response on that is, he's a very versatile actor. He's a very capable actor. Don't worry. You know, if you're getting hung up on the fact that that you see an actor and you're looking back on their previous body of work to say that that's what they're going to put into the next piece of work they put their hands on, you've got to think about, you know, where Eccleston came from, where Tennant came from, and how they completely redefined both of the roles, but they redefined themselves to suit the role. So, you know, that's, you know, he had said something to the effect of, you know, the first time you see the picture of him, you know, where he's got his hand to his face, you know, that in and of itself is something that is neither what you know of Capaldi previously nor what you know of the Doctor previously. This is a new man, new character, new role. Go.
Yeah. So it definitely seems very promising. I'm excited. I'm not excited to see Matt Smith leave, but I can't wait to see what Capaldi does with his role.
Moffat actually brought up an interesting part of the tail end of that interview, by the way, and that had to do with the fact that he's thinking progressively about the future of the show. He's like, you know, think about, you know, bringing in somebody who is, you know, because there was some criticism about, why did you go with a known name? Why didn't you go with somebody who is, you know, right out of the, you know, come right out of the woodwork sort of thing and grab a new face, or not even necessarily a young face, but just a new face? And he said, well, if you take somebody who's completely out of that genre, Anagrin, yes, I know, he was in that episode before, he was in Torchwood before, but you wouldn't necessarily qualify him as a sci-fi actor. But you go and you put him into the show, you can get somebody who comes over and they start watching Doctor Who for the first time simply because it's got Peter Capaldi in it and they're a fan of his other work. So it's something where all of a sudden you realize, well, I didn't think this was going to be my kind of show, but I like what he's doing with it because he's sort of my touch point. Well, I guess I kind of like this show now. And it's a way, again, to sort of further the franchise or keep the show, you know, constantly expanding and finding new audiences. Not necessarily always the next generation of viewers, you know, bring them in at the young age, but you could find mature viewers as well who came into it for 1,000 different reasons. This is just another reason.
Yeah. Well, we've also got some other stuff, minor news coming out. The company that brought us the Sonic Screwdriver app that we talked about a little while ago, they've come out with the official TARDIS app. And this is basically just a fun little toy. Again, nothing overly impressive, but basically you hold your phone up and you see the TARDIS in flight, you know, going through either the vortex or space or whatever. And then if you set it down on a stable surface or on a flat surface, the camera will come alive and you'll actually see the TARDIS land on whatever you set your phone on.
The cat.
Yes. If you ever wanted to see the TARDIS land on your cat, you can do it.
I test all of my Whovian apps on the cat.
That is fantastic. it's just a fun little thing. Again, I mean, the big thing coming from this is the fact that we're getting, you know, officially licensed apps. They might not make a huge splash right now, but the fact that, you know, BBC Worldwide is really putting this stuff out there, saying we need to actively promote the name of Doctor Who. You know, we need to actively put it out there in more than just 14 episodes a year. You know, yeah. That is awesome to me.
Mm-hmm. And it just means that they're loosening the grip, so to speak, and allowing some of these development partnerships with little app developers or site promoters or whatever it may be, merchandise or clothing lines or who knows what.
Smartphone games.
Oh, gee, I think we might be involved in some of those. That it just means that there is the opportunity for fans who have creative abilities to start coming up with something that, who knows, you know, you could definitely catch the attention of the right people at the right time. You know, we talk about, again, I'm going back to the app thing, with the guys from Seed for developing Legacy, and they were probably just fans. We'll find out soon enough, but they were fans who had a great idea, and they thought they would go a little farther if they got official sanction from it, and did so. And it's growing exponentially.
Yep. So, and then leading into Christmas, you know, we're a week away today as we record this. So you've got, have you got all your Christmas shopping done?
I'm still catching up on Thanksgiving. I'm, you know, still inviting people over for dinner. No, I'm not prepared.
Yeah. So I'm not either. I've still got last minute gifts to go, but thankfully I found something that, that my Whovian friends are going to enjoy. And especially if you're, you know, if you're starting your journey into Classic Who, this is going to be a great companion to that. There's a book that I found, and I'm not sure how long it's been out, but this is called Doctor Who, A History of the Universe and 100 Objects. And this is basically just like an encyclopedia of 100 different things that have appeared in Doctor Who. You know, you've got Stonehenge, the Pandorica, they've got a section on the TARDIS, you know, Mad Scientists, the Rachnos Web Star, just random different objects that have been in Doctor Who. And it goes into immense detail, sometimes, you know, talking about the object itself, if it's something like Stonehenge, something that actually exists, the actual history, and then also the history in the show. It's just for anyone that likes to dig into the nitty gritty and find out all the little details that you can possibly get, this is going to be a fantastic book. And I've already told everyone I know that this, you know, if you haven't bought me something yet, this is a thing.
Nice.
I expect to get 5 copies of this for Christmas.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, there's a lot of book material out there that I know. One of the things I just recently picked up was the vault, as they refer to it, which is the big 50th compendium they put together. And there's so much great stuff in it, behind the scenes and on location interviews. Even when you first open the thing up, on the inside binding of the book are the we talked about this months ago, the blueprints from the original production floor of all the interior shots. So that's what you get to see the moment you first crack a cover, I think. So yeah, there's some great book material out there right now. Plus, I think the official release date for the 11 short stories is January 7th, I want to say. I'm pulling this out of my butt as we speak. But so that you can get all of the short stories that were written for the 11 Doctors over the course of the last year. They've now put them together strictly paperback formats. You pick it up for $11 on Amazon. That's US dollars, of course. Sorry, Canada. and have that. So I've already got my pre-ordered copy and waiting to get the official word when that hits to give me something to read in the morning as I'm making my coffee. So.
Awesome. So yeah, lots of stuff that you can get. But that's about all we've got for the news this week. Not a lot. We didn't expect a whole heck of a lot coming this week. Being right before the Christmas special, so we're gonna have that next week. So I'm excited about this. You know, I mean, we after having such a huge long pause or break between the end of series 7 and the Christmas or the 50th anniversary, you know, here we are, you know, not even a month as we sit here from the 50th anniversary, and we're already talking about a new episode. So it's nice. And then we're going to have, like, you know, 8 or 9 months to gripe and complain about the wait till the next one.
Yeah. So don't sweat the time break just yet. We'll find ways to keep you busy. We'll give you projects. Oh, yeah. homework assignments for what to do over your summer.
There will be quizzes. There will be. All right. Well, so next week we will be talking The Time of the Doctor, and hopefully Melissa's technical issues will be out of the way by then so she can join us for that. Mm-hmm. Until then, you know, let us know if there's something that you feel needed to be included in this list. Go onto the show notes at GallifreyPublicRadio.com and include your stuff there. Let other people know what other episodes you feel need to be included in it. And if you're going to use this list to start your own journey, let us know how you do. Let us know if you made it to a certain point and just broke away to delve deeper, or if you couldn't get through certain ones or something. Let us know how your usage varies.
Your miles may vary.
So, you can send us email at feedback@GallifreyPublicRadio.com. You can find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. On iTunes, you can call us 210-802-1477. Leave us voicemails to put in next week's show. All kinds of ways you can get a hold of us. And as we announced last week, you can also find us on GunnaGeek.com now. And if you haven't yet, go check them out. Find some of the other shows that are on there that you may enjoy listening to as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of other areas.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, because we every once in a while, will watch something else or read something else or get into something else. It's a world of crossovers, Jay. It's going to be okay.
I can't deal with it.
Just ride it out. And then when you get all of your passions all stirred up in a tizzy, like that, I use the word tizzy, then you can come join us at Geekation 2014 out in Las Vegas next April and squee all over the place with the rest of us. So
it's going to be a mess.
Yes, the good kind of mess. The one that you have to clean up before your mom gets home.
All right. Well, this has been episode 65 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying you are taking your first step on a much larger journey.
And this is Gear saying, hey, you remember the Mona Lisa? That dreadful woman with no eyebrows who wouldn't sit still, huh? Hey, your idea for the helicopter took a bit longer to catch on, but as I say, these things take time.
We'll see you guys next week.
I'll see you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@GallifreyPublicRadio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows by calling 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1477 to leave us a voicemail. You can head to GallifreyPublicRadio.com to leave comments on each episode. There you can also keep up to date on all the latest news and gossip, as well as what's going on in the community. Also make sure to head over to GunnaGeek.com to find out lots of other high-quality, geek-centric shows. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.